Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's Resource Use Steering Committee conference call. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the call over to Sarah Fanta. Please go ahead.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for making it on the call today to go over the comments that we received for Cycle 1. This is Sarah Fanta, and I'm joined here with Tarun and Ashley by phone and Helen Burston as well. We also have Chad Heim from Health Partners on the phone and Ben Hamlin from NCQA to answer any questions that we might have about the measures that were submitted. Right now, we're currently having a problem with our webinar, so you won't be able to see anything on the screen right now. We're working on fixing it, so hopefully it will come up as the call progresses. But if everyone has the documents that were emailed to them, that's what we're going to be going over today, and I'll make reference to the documents as we go through the call so you are looking at the same thing that we are. I'm sorry. I apologize for this. So the objectives for today's call are to go over the comments that we received during the public and member comment period for Cycle 1 and for the steering committee to provide responses to those comments.
You're getting a considerable echo.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. Caroline?
It's okay on my end.
Yeah, same here.
Okay, Caroline, I'm not sure if there's anything that we can do about that, but... Okay, and this call is also an opportunity to provide recommendations on changes to the Cycle 1 draft report prior to the member voting period. Real quick, I'm going to go over the steering committee roster just to make sure we have everyone on the call that's supposed to be here. Tom Rosenthal?
Here.
Okay. Bruce?
I'm here.
Okay. Paul Barnett? Okay. Jack Bowen?
Yes.
Okay. Jephtha? Okay. Kurt Elward? Bill Golden? Lisa Graybert? Ethan Holm? Ann Hendrick? Tom Lee, Jack Needleman,
here.
Thank you. Mary Kay O'Neill,
I'm here.
Great, thanks. David Penson, Doris Peter, Steve Phillips. David Redfern?
Present.
Jeff Rich? Will Rich?
Bill, here.
Will Rich, thanks. Great. Barb?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. Joe Stefanski? Jim Weinstein? And Loris Yanagihara?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, great. Thank you, everyone.
Do we have a quorum? We've got a lot of people missing.
Let's see here. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We have nine people on the call.
And this is Helen, and technically, since you're not actually voting on anything today, it's really just to discuss it. The staff will summarize it and send it to everybody. So you're probably okay to proceed. We also find a good number of people signed in the first 15 minutes or so. So for something like this, you're probably okay to proceed.
Okay, and just to give everyone a brief recap of what we've done up to date, right now, the Cycle 1 draft report public and member comment period has closed. It closed on September 28th. And just as a reminder, that was on 2 Health Partners measures and 2 NCQA measures. The Cycle 2 draft report will be posted for public and member comment on October 17th and will be closing on November 15th. And that will be on 2 Ingenix measures and 2 NCQA measures and the 1 diabetes measure from Ingenix where no consensus was reached. So the next thing coming up for Cycle 1 is the member voting period, which will be from October 24th until November 7th. And it will also be reviewed by CSAC on November 2nd and 3rd. And then for Cycle 2, the public member comment period will begin October 17th until November 15th. And the member voting period will take place from January 3rd to January 16th, so a little ways away. So the most pressing thing that's coming up is the conference call taking place on December 5th from 12 to 2, and we'll send more information as that approaches to discuss the Cycle 2 comments and the draft report comments. On October 26th, we'll be having a pre-member voting webinar for Cycle 1. So that's just an opportunity for the project staff to present the comments that were received and to just inform the members of what's going on in the project prior to their vote. Committee attendance isn't required, but if you would like to dial in, that will be posted on the NQF site as well as emailed to you when exactly that's taking place. And just as a reminder, on November 2nd and 3rd, CSAC will be going over the resource use project and the recommended measures. So we can also send you the agenda and dial information if you want to call in and listen to that. Okay, so for the Cycle 1 comment period, we received 93 comments from 35 organizations. And you should have all received an email last week. So we have bucketed the comments from the report into themes, and those themes have been captured in the memo. Like I said, that was sent out last week. The comments that required developer responses were then forwarded to the developer for them to provide a response, and those responses were inserted into the spreadsheet and were highlighted in green. For the remaining responses, which were the majority, the project team proposed responses for each individual comment, and that's reflected on the spreadsheet, and to the themes that were identified, which is in the memo. The responses to the themes overlap with the individual responses to the comment, to the topic, so we'll just go over them as themes and the committee responses. So basically, the goals for today's call are just to discuss the comment themes and any other individual comments that the committee feels are important. And like I said, because there were so many comments, rather than go through each individually, we should probably just start with the themes addressed in the memo and then circle back to any individual comments. We also wanted to check in to make sure that the committee feels that our project team accurately represented the committee's stance on the issues and anything that should be added or clarified. We also need to identify any issues that should be actually reflected in the report itself, so anything that jumped out at you or any comments that you feel should be addressed in further detail we can go over. We also need to confirm the committee's consensus on the recommendations on the four measures. A revote is not required. We just need a verbal agreement that consensus was reached because there was some division among the committee members on health partners measures, like 1598 and 1604. So if any of the comments changed any of the committee's opinions or if the committee is still comfortable moving these four measures forward. Are there any questions before we begin? Okay, and Tom and Bruce, I'm going to hand it over to you if you want to get started, perhaps with the first theme.
Oh, you're putting us to work?
Bruce, take it away, Bruce.
Okay. I can read it, too. It's up to you guys.
I think you did a good job at summarizing the comments into the five buckets. I don't know that there were any others. If any committee members think that there's a missing theme, they should speak up at some point. But in general, Tom, why don't we alternate?
That's fine. Go ahead and get us started on theme one.
Okay.
Important. Is everybody comfortable with this agenda? Is everybody happy with the agenda?
Yeah, it seems like the comments paralleled our discussion pretty well, I think.
Okay, so we'll pound through the themes, and So Bruce,
I agree, Tom. I think the comments were well summarized by the staff into the appropriate buckets.
Okay.
The importance of measuring at the individual and group practice level, and what was that? Anyway, the Pacific Business Group on Health, I think, was hammered at that one pretty good, and others did as well. And I think the general response that you prepared, I think, is accurate. that we generally think it would be important to have measures at the individual and small group level, provided that they meet the criteria that we've set forth for the scientific acceptability in particular. I don't know that we need to go any further than that, but would anyone like to add a comment on that?
Yes. Bruce, this is Barb Rudolph. I think the concern was that in other kind of quality measures, the level of application, each level of application did not require testing of reliability and validity for that level. I think the concern was that because somehow this was individual physicians, that there was a higher bar for those measures to meet than in previous sort of endorsement processes.
I see.
Barb, this is Helen. If I could just jump in, we actually do require testing on the level of analysis. That's actually quite standard. You may recall a measure fairly recently on birth outcomes that a lot of the folks on the CSAC wanted to push down to the lower level of analysis that just hadn't been tested yet. I don't think this is a different standard.
Okay.
Hey, guys, it's David Penson. Sorry I had some troubles getting here.
Hi, we're glad you're here now, David.
Jeff Rich here, too. Sorry.
Generally, we're going over the themes of the public comments, and we're on number one, which is that the measures – there were a number of comments that the measures also should be applicable to individual and group practice level, and the staff response generally is, in two sentences, the committee agrees, but the measures specified at that level should be able to demonstrate reliability and validity. Does anybody else want to opine on the adequacy of the, I mean, because we're not, you know, we discuss this rather endlessly in our meetings. That was
right. I would note that there's a link here to what I think is theme three, the attribution issue.
Right.
That pushing down to the individual level also requires that the attribution algorithm be one that is acceptable. Not simply, it is one of testing at reliability and validity at that low level, at the level of the individual group or the group of physicians that are treating the patient or the individual physician that is to whom that patient is attributed. And that can be a sample size problem, which is noted here. But it's also one of attribution. Are we assigning the patient to the right individual?
Well, as we talked about in the last face-to-face meeting, Jack, I think you're exactly right, and as we talked about in the last face-to-face meeting when we were trying to kind of tee up next steps, I think one of the themes that got identified was the interrelationship between attribution, statistical validity, and what's being measured, and that in our own conception of it and articulation of it up till now, these things have been siloed, and that we needed to be more explicit perhaps in the final document of the interconnectedness to those things. I think that to the extent that there's any confusion about this or lack of clarity, it's because we could do one level better of articulating our view, the committee's view of the interconnectedness of those.
Well, this is Mary Kay, and I think, you know, a piece of the, you know, importance or meaningfulness of the measures is that they're actionable, and, you know, something needs to be actionable, like a physician should be able to look at a measure and somehow or other figure out what they should be doing differently. But in terms of the measures that were submitted to us and the nature of their development, you know, we didn't have a huge amount to work with. I didn't feel on that level. Maybe I missed something. And I know this is I'm new to NQF in this cycle, so just to find measure developers that work at that level, I don't know if that's a gap, but that's a huge issue is my understanding. And, you know, I think we did a good job looking at what we had to review, and there just wasn't, other than the health partners, very much it seemed to me really down at the level of, you know, giving the feedback to the individual physician of what they should do.
Right. Just as a this is Bruce, as a reminder, the there is a huge program operating at the individual physician level that's at CMS at the direction of Congress to give individual physicians feedback. But
yeah.
Obviously CMS didn't submit their measures to us, so you know, we're not in a position to comment.
Yeah.
Any more discussion? Staff, do you feel like you've gotten some guidance on maybe tweaking some of the language, or
yeah.
do we need more?
No, I think it's about right. We're going to go back and take a look, at least in as an update to draft report 2, to try to make sure that we're capturing, as Bruce, you and Tom have noted, the interconnectedness of the reliability and validity at that level. But I think what was clear for us was to make sure that the voice of the committee of not stating a preference of a level of analysis was important. So I think we got it. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, that was Tom and Jack, actually. Go ahead.
Okay, sorry. I'm sorry. Sorry, everyone. This is Sarah again. I just restarted the webinar, so hopefully you should be able to see something on your screen. Is everyone seeing something?
Yes.
Perfect. Okay, thank you.
It looks like it's the memo, though, right? So.
It is, yes.
Okay, all right, perfect.
Thank you.
All right, well, if we're finished with that, let's move to the costing approach. And here the general theme of the comments were the strong preference that both actual costs as well as standardized costs approach should be considered. I think, again, the staff response is generally we agree, but that for national measures, particularly if what you're measuring is actual utilization, then the utilization factors across the country would be preferable. But this isn't a rejection of it. This is not Manichaeistic. We discuss this almost ad nauseum, but the people feel that the staff responses here are generally sufficient, or do they need to be fleshed out?
This is David Redfern, and I think this kind of misses the point. An issue that I've been pushing, and I noticed that one of David Hopkins' comments hit the nail right on the head from my point of view. It's not that actual costs or synthetic costs are better than the other. They have different purposes, and like you said, we've discussed that a lot. But the NQF seems to be making an argument that any measure can only have one. You have to choose. You can't have both. And the point that David Hopkins was making, and I strongly agree with this, is that I don't understand that. I don't understand the necessity for that. The measures complement each other, and allowing measure developers to have both kinds of measures, both kinds of outcome measures included in their definition of the measure just adds value. It doesn't confuse anything at all. So that's the problem for me, is that the little section in the paper that discusses this, frankly, I just don't understand it, and just reading it literally, I don't agree with it. So that's my point. It's not that one is better than the other. I think the question is, why can't we have both?
I think, and this takes us back to when we asked health partners to split their measure, right?
Yeah.
Where the sense was we could have two measures. We wanted them to be submitted and evaluated as separate measures, as opposed to one measure with an either or switch. So I don't think there's any prejudice against one or the other way of measuring costs. And in fact, I agree certainly with you, David, they can be complementary. And we've learned from the developers and their customers that, in fact, they often are complementary. They often are both utilized by the users. So as long as we get that down on paper in a clear manner, is there still a remaining issue for the committee?
There is.
Well, I'm not sure we've specified in the words, though, that have been used, because I think the semantic, and I think it's just a semantic problem, not a conceptual problem. I think there's unanimity that, for example, a population-based measure that uses dollars could be used, and exactly the same measure with standardized pricing could be used, and in fact, they would be complementary. I think what the staff was trying to articulate is that you can't have an either-or and where it's random, and then one person uses it with standardized pricing, that quote, the same measure, whereas somebody else uses it with dollar-denominated measurement, and you would have apples and oranges in the same measure. That's, I think, what the staff is trying to articulate is the reason for specifying that an individual measure has to be one or the other, but somebody could easily submit more or less the exact same measure, but with the two different measuring tools, but they would then be two measures.
Right. Yeah.
So there would be clarity. It's a matter of clarity, not a matter of prejudice. Am I saying that correctly?
That's exactly correct, Tom. That's true. And as it's also to reflect the conversation that, Bruce, you noted on the health partners measure, and that it was the will of the committee to separate the individual measure into two different ones based on the costing approach, that there could only be one costing approach within an individual measure. However, there was no preference on one versus the other, and they should be evaluated individually.
But maybe we could even add it in to say that, in fact, they could very well be complementary. To make it clear that what we're not trying to articulate that only one is preferable. David, does my rendition of it meet your concerns?
Well, I still have some concerns about it. I wrote comments to the language in the paper that I didn't really understand it. I read the text, and maybe again this is a matter of just fleshing it out and communicating it a little bit clearer, is that somehow having both alternatives destroyed the usefulness of the measure. And I recall that Ingenix essentially, now Ingenix was the next stage, but Ingenix was basically told, well, you can't do both, you have to choose one. And frankly, I think that put them at something of a disadvantage when they presented their measures. So, maybe it's a matter of clarity as you're suggesting, but if that's the case, then I think we need to make it clearer.
Well, I agree with that actually on the more reflection, because it shouldn't be confusing, and yet apparently the way we've written it, it's confusing. But I do think it's a semantic thing, because within a single measure, it shouldn't be dealer's choice, because that leaves ambiguity and the high probability, in fact, that one person will apply the measure one way and somebody else will apply it the other way, and you will not have comparable outcomes, which is bad. You'd have ambiguity.
This is Ashley. Hi, everyone. I just wanted to clarify really quickly on David's last comment. Ingenix was given the exact same options in terms of splitting their measure as Health Partners was. They could either split it in two measures and submit both an actual and a standardized pricing approach, or they could choose to just apply one methodology. It was their choice to only resubmit using actual prices. So I just wanted to clarify that both developers were given the exact same options in terms of splitting their costing approaches amongst the measures.
That's my recollection as well. And in fact, it was surprising to me that they elected not to submit both, because it would have been much, much stronger.
Can I also ask a clarifying question to Tom and Bruce? It does seem like the comment that came from PBGH and what David is bringing up right now is actually trying to get at the question of that both costing approaches should be allowed in a single measure. And it seems very clear from the committee's consensus that should not be the case, that no particular costing approach should be is preferred, but yet no individual measure could have both costing approaches built into a single measure. I just want
only because it creates ambiguity.
Right.
The problem with the standardized pricing is that by itself it is communicating a dollar figure that is a hypothetical. You know, I mean, it's using the dollars to communicate the relative use of of resources in an episode of care to kind of true up the relative size of a expensive and inexpensive input and come out with some standard number that takes the form of dollars to be able to compare different systems and how they're utilizing something. So if you standardize pricing and some entity uses lots and lots of low-cost inputs and a very few high-cost, and the other entity uses lots of high-cost and very little low-cost, you can see the difference in the magnitude of the utilization of different kinds of inputs. But the risk of using standardized pricing is people will interpret them to mean cost. So what we have to do is figure out a way to clearly communicate when we're using standardized pricing and when we're using actual costs. And both of them have values for these different reasons, because dollars are an actual resource that's utilized in healthcare, I mean real dollars. And so it's according to what question's being asked and how it needs to be answered, and we just have to make sure we're not muddling something that looks like a dollar figure with another thing that looks like a dollar figure that's on a totally different basis. But the measures could be essentially the same in terms of how they're capturing data. It's just what unit they're being reported out in needs to be crystal clear.
Right. It's just an ambiguity issue, not a preference issue. And you're exactly right. You could have two identical measures, but one of them says that the outcome is measured in dollars, and the other says it's measured in standardized pricing, otherwise exactly identical.
Yeah, and this is David. I mean, from my point of view, having two copies of the same measure with a different outcome unit of analysis or measure is the same thing as allowing the same measure to have both done and choose which one you use, as long as you tell people what you've used.
Well, except the committee was pretty definitive about saying we preferred it to be done the other way, and mainly because when we weren't that specific, we ended up with it being ambiguous.
So I'm wondering if there's an opportunity to note in the measure itself that this is the same measure as measure number blah, 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 except it has a different method for pricing it. And so that you make the link, people know it's the same measure but with different costing methodologies. So then you've got both the clarity, but you also aren't trying to figure out, is this the same or different? How is this different? It looks the same as the other one. You have a lot of clarity there just by stating that.
Right. But I think we have to explain it better in the report. I think the critique is, and crap, David was in every meeting, and if he still read the thing and was uncertain as to what our intent was in the report or even in these comments, it probably needs a little work to explain.
Well, honestly, sometimes I think I'm in a different meeting than anybody else.
Well, I'm not gonna make any reference to the interpretation of that, David.
This is Bruce. I'm certainly in agreement with the substance of what you've said. The only area it sounds like there could be some disagreement is with the committee's decision that there should be two measures, not one measure with an either or in it. I'm also agreeing with Tom that we were fairly definitive about that. But I guess the contextual discussion needs to make it clear that the reason for doing that was not to express a preference for one or the other. It was to reduce ambiguity and make it clear what the measure was measuring, as opposed to potentially incurring some risk of ambiguity.
This is Barbara Rudolph. I totally agree with David Redfern's interpretation, actually. And I had the feeling when I read the comments, too, that there was sort of a negative feel about the actual cost measures, in the comments themselves, saying, that they shouldn't be used nationally and so forth. I think, it would be better to be slightly more neutral in the remarks and at... I guess the one problem I have with the measures being separated, and I don't think I was on the call that made the vote about this, was that it's entirely possible that, a measure could come through a steering committee and only one piece of it actually get approved. And then
one really wonders what's happening because, it, you know, it's essentially the same measure. So I just think that we have to really think about, you know, how we're, what message we're sending for down the line for the maintenance committees and so forth. We'll be looking at these things in the future. Do we really want to do this separate always, or can there be a different options within a single measure so that the measure developer who comes in and is using both parts in their work would not find themselves in a situation where one part of it, the standardized pricing, got approved and then the alternative option was not approved, leaving them hanging out to dry, so to speak, you know, with their measurement activities.
Other comments?
Well, this is Jack. It strikes me standardized pricing goes slightly beyond. It's a, one additional level of analysis beyond the actual pricing, because it requires having an additional set of algorithms for producing it. I didn't see us as having a preference for one over the other. There was this, my sense of the conversation was there was a sense that there was valuable and unique or distinctive information in each of the measures. Standardized pricing told you one, let certain kinds of comparisons be easier, and the actual pricing let other kinds of comparisons be easier. And that there was a general feeling that we'd like to see measures with both. But to the extent you have to, so it was a matter of being clear about the labeling and making sure the labeling was distinct enough that people knew what the measure was and what the numbers were telling them. So it's that sense that you know, each has value, and we'd like to see both, and then the issue is simply how do you endorse them and define them clearly enough that what goes into the measure is clear, could be made clear in the report. I think that would help.
Well, in my recollection of some of the discussions, the only negative notion about costed, from my recollection of the discussion, was when it was going to be applied at an individual physician level, where the conclusion would be is this physician was more efficient than that physician. And in general, the individual physician is only responsible for their utilization choices. They have very little control over their labor markets. They have very little control over the cost of items, and therefore, if one were going to try to say physician X is in one part of the country is more efficient than physician Y in another part of the country, by at least some notion of what efficiency means in relationship to physicians, that standardized pricing was preferable. I do remember, but the counter argument is, but some national employer really will want to know that Blue Cross in one part of the country, you know, dollar cost is different than in another part of the country, and they don't really care why. So, but there are circumstances where one is going to make more sense than the other, depending on their utilization, and there is a potential for misuse.
Okay, well, let's make sure that the language that describes that is really neutral, so that someone doesn't read it and come away with the sense that there's a bias and a preference for one versus the other.
Right.
Okay.
I agree.
Can we go on to theme three, attribution? Already have had a little bit of discussion that there's a relationship between attribution and other criteria. I guess as I read the comments and the summary of them, the issue seems to revolve around attribution being guidelines as opposed to being more concrete requirements. Is there any discussion of that? I don't know that I recommend any changes, but others may feel differently.
Certainly, the discussion on that distribution went way beyond the implication of simplicity of the partner's argument about excluding docs. It's much more complex, and it actually is a leading problem, I think, statistical validity. If you recall, a lot of Brookings measures because for it. It's a very, very complex issue, and I think the answer in this after simplistic. I don't know how to find out any more than that.
Anything else, any further?
Well, it's interesting. CMS's comment basically says they think the attribution should be more specific. And the family physicians say, we're happy that it's just a guideline. Go figure.
Well, I guess they cancel each other out.
This is Barbara Rudolph, and just from experience with some regional collaboratives, frequently the physician groups who are measured in a regional area are likely to have input about the attribution process. And so the form of guidelines is actually helpful to, regional efforts in terms of getting physician buy-in to the measurement process. So I'd like to see it stay as guidelines because I think, it's an area where physicians have strong feelings about the attribution approach, and there's usually a process in place. And I know Health Partners left it as a guideline because they felt that, they had gotten input from their physicians in terms of what the attribution approach should be. So I think that part in terms of getting buy-in for measurement can be very important. So I'd prefer to see it left as guidelines as opposed to a specific standard.
Well, our task here isn't to really change anything. Our task, I think, is to merely determine whether or not our responses to the queries are sufficient. So I don't think we're not going to change anything. And you make a very, Barb, you make a really good set of arguments about why leaving it as a guideline is preferable. But I think you can also see where CMS comes down of saying, but if we really want to hold accountable. So in the scenario you're describing is where doctors, in fact, want to use these for improvement opportunities, terrific. You want a guideline. You want flexibility. But in the scenario where you're really going to hold this group of primary care doctors accountable for the difference in efficiencies from that one, you'd probably want to be sure that, in fact, the same methodology was used.
Yeah. Well, one of the big problems about methodology and attribution in the commercial insurance world is that the tools you have to do the attribution vary incredibly based on the insurance product. So if you're running an HMO product, the attribution is almost inherent in the database of the plan. And if you're running a PPO product, it's not at all. You have to make guesses and make rules and all of those kinds of things. And so it's a little tricky out there in the real world to have something that's too restrictive. And what we found in our multi-payer project in Washington is when you start trying to get too prescriptive about this, what you end up having is huge fallout in relatively small percentages of a individual physician's practice can be attributed at all. So, I think this is a work in progress.
But maybe to the staff, though, that is a suggestion that our answers really, as I read the two competing ones, we sort of say, yeah, okay, is kind of our answer. And maybe our answer should reflect a little of this back and forth that we understand that for strict national comparisons, it would probably be necessary or desirable to have a more proscribed attribution model. The other point of view is that it for all the reasons that Barb just enunciated, guidelines can also be useful.
Yeah.
And we elected at this moment in time, given the state of the science, which if we were honest about it is really got some room to grow. This is where the committee came down.
Yeah,
and I would just put that in the discussion. A national guideline CMS requires specificity, but based on the insurance product, you can't prescribe it. You have flexibility. So just put that in there for the readers.
And that would also be a good idea because you're going to run head-on into this when we go into phase two and talk about the NGenix approach, in which they have about a half dozen different ways of doing attribution.
Right.
And that certainly reflects the way that product has been pushed out and sold to customers. I mean, that kind of flexibility is sort of an inherent feature of the product.
Yeah, again, which is not a problem. We've been working with NGenix, so it's clearly not a problem when you're buying the product and you only intend to use it for improvement and in the way that Barbara described. The challenge is that when you start to say, I want to compare UCLA in California with some other group in Ohio, and the attribution methodology is not specified. And so there's, again, risk of ambiguity. There's the risk of apples and oranges and all the rest of that, which is, again, I think the point of view that CMS is taking in this thing, which is going to be, we want a national standard. We don't want there to be ambiguity.
But that's what they have.
So I think we should acknowledge the tension between these two things. And the fact is we came down on the side of tolerance in this first go-round, but we recognize the two poles of the argument.
Sounds good to me. Staff, do you have enough to work with there?
Yeah, that's good. Thank you.
Okay. If no further discussion, then, Tom, we're on.
I guess we're on to complexity of resource use measures. Anybody have any comments on this? I'm not sure even how to summarize it. The resource use measures are inherently complex. And our response is we're striving to make them simple and transparent as possible, but it's difficult. Anybody have any suggestions on how to articulate that better?
I'm just wondering if it's the measure. I mean, the measure can be simple in the sense of, you know, there's a set of processes. The processes themselves are complex. Does every single piece of the measure have to be completely understandable by all audiences? I guess I don't know any other form of science where every single, you know, component is reduced to a simple statement. I just think the expectation is rather high that some of these internal processes might, you know, not be, you know, quickly understood by everyone who looked at the measure.
That's what the comments are. They're saying don't worry about it, that they're complex and not easy and transparent. But again, I thought I did, in fact, hear from the committee with some regularity, and I feel it myself at times. Many of the quality, because every time you say most or all or something, it's wrong. But lots of the quality measures are, in fact, simple. You know, bloodstream infection rates, you either have it or you don't. Pressure ulcers, you either have them or you don't. ACE inhibitors with heart failure, you either gave them or you didn't. There's not a complex set of formulas residing behind them, and yet here, particularly with these population-based methods, there's a ton of complexity, and I think the NGenix or the other developers would tell you that it is true. There's a ton of complexity. It tends to be easier to articulate to stakeholders and things what the meaning is when you don't have to spend, you know, 2 weeks explaining the methodology to where they go, oh, I see, now I'll accept the fact I'm being measured this way. It is what it is.
Right. I agree. And but I think the issue is, I mean, there are some quality measures when I think about some of the hierarchical modeling that has occurred for some of the mortality measures, and that
your average person isn't going to understand hierarchical modeling, and therefore, you know, should we not approve the measure because it's complex? So
right.
I think that the idea is that the results should be understandable from the measure, and that that there ought to be, you know, well-specified processes, but does everybody have to know exactly how every code is grouped or, you know, I don't know.
Well, do we overstate this in the report? Does anybody know? Does anybody think of the sort of language that's actually in the report that prompted these comments? I mean, do we wail on about how awful it is that they're complicated?
Well, I don't.
I didn't think we did actually.
We should a couple of statements.
Huh?
There were a couple of statements, and I don't know if it was in this report or in the second one, because I was reading both of them. So there were statements about the complexity and that it was to the steering committee what exactly what was happening in the measure. So,
I do think we should strive to have the results interpretable.
Yes, I agree.
Well, and Barb, would it be fair to say that one other difference between these and some of the quality ones is most of those quality ones ended up having a pretty substantial peer review literature to where not only was it, you're right, it may have been complicated and it would have taken some degree of ability to sort through it, but it was all out there for anybody to see, and much of this has not been out there for people to see.
True, it has not, and that may be an issue, but I just think that the average person isn't going to be able to take their data and run it through, you know, unless they purchase the groupers, unless they use the groupers, they aren't going to be able to do this on their own, period, you know, unless they have the tools. So the idea
But that's part of the lack of transparency that I think at least concerns some people on the committee. That not
right.
only, with the exception of what I recall David Redfern saying was, you could get on NGENIC's website, and if you had a PhD in economics, you could, over a course of several weeks, work your way through all of it to validate it. I'm exaggerating, David, but not by much. I'm exaggerating, but not by much. But otherwise, I think Barbara's right. These are less transparent than some other measures have been, and there's a modicum of concern. But I don't think it was overstated in the document. But if somebody wants to go dig out the language, I'm sure it could be tweaked and modified to make it more accurate of our sentiment.
I would argue that the measure is no less transparent than any of the other measures because it's fully documented. It is more complicated, though, and difficult to learn, but it's published. And so you have to argue about what's the definition of transparency. And I would argue that transparency means it's completely documented, and it is. It's just very, very complicated.
Well, I would submit that, again, at least in the quality realm, transparent is more than published. It's published and subject to peer review, and I guess the counter-argument to that here with regard to, say, to NGENIC is, well, the peer review has been relevant. People have actually purchased it, and in one regard, is that just not as valid a kind of endorsement of the scientific acceptability as having been published in peer review literature?
Well, I would also add to that we had a TAP thoroughly reviewed into all kinds of methodological issues in it, as did we as a steering committee. So you've been playing the role of peer reviewers to some extent in this.
Right. Well, we've endorsed them. The only question on the table here is staff's answers to the people who made comments about the complexity, are we satisfied with the staff answers, or do we think they need to be tweaked, or does the report itself need to be tweaked?
Right. Well, you know, the one thing I would add, we've been, you know, this conversation and the response speaks a great deal to transparency, which I think is very important. But the other issue is usability. We spent a lot of time thinking about whether these measures were
produced numbers that were sufficiently clear that people could use them in for appropriate use. And we that gets us to AIM issue 5, which is the incompleteness of the measures is just measures of resource use, and only some resources at that. But I would add usability as another measure of whether the measures are too complex. And I think we address that in our usability review.
All right. Well, to sort of bring this to a close, because, again, the purpose of the conversation isn't to rehash all the debates that and back and forth that we had in the meeting. It was to discern, do we think the report is written satisfactorily or needs to be modified based on the comments, and or that the comments of the staff are sufficient. And I'm not hearing a dramatic proposition to change either one at the moment.
So.
I'm going to interpret silence as agreement.
Yes.
Yep.
Okay.
All right. Let's go.
All right. So then let's move on to theme 5, Bruce.
Theme 5, yeah. Linking quality and resource use measures. You know, from our earliest first face-to-face meeting, you know, we have, I think, been pretty explicit that resource use measures are not efficiency measures. They're a way station to arriving at efficiency measures. And, you know, and maybe it's just because we've stated that point so many times, I thought it was pretty clear. So I guess I'm surprised to see that some commenters say that we need to make that clear. Nonetheless, if we're not clear enough, then we should be. And we should be, I think, also a little careful about our language. I noticed that in the response the word value has crept in, and I don't know that we need it. I think it's reasonably understandable, but I think it should be sufficient for our purposes to say, yes, resource use measures are not efficiency measures. We would like to move in the direction of developing efficiency measures. Once we do, the concepts of quality and outcome need to be brought into the measurement process and leave it at that without adding new concepts, let's put it that way.
I would take out the word value, and we've had this robust discussions last year, and clear to us in the outside world this is part of the equation, but just on one side of that.
Is that Dr. Rich? Is that?
Yeah.
Yes. You're breaking up a little bit. I think I agreed with what you said, if I only could have heard it. But
if I don't say anything, will you also agree with me?
Absolutely.
Maybe it's a little bit. No, I just said that I think it is clear to us, as you pointed out. And I just think I would just drop the word value from there and just emphasize this is an evolving process, as you stated.
Okay. Anyone else? All right, then I think we're done with the...
I was sitting here reading, and I'm sorry, this is Tom again. I actually went back on the complexity thing, and I was reading these complexity comments. And the critique of us was that, in fact, somehow we dismissed things because they were too complex, and that's just not true. I'm reading this one from the National Partnership for Women's, and they said we can't understand why the steering committee applied explainability criteria to the measures. And we didn't really. We just saying that we think they should be explainable if they're going to be usable, back to Jack's point. So, but I think the comments are mistaking what we did. I apologize for going back on the thing, but maybe in our staff responses, we could clarify that I don't believe we rejected anything because it was too complex and not understandable. We just believe that transparency and understandableness and clarity are important attributes, are useful attributes. All right, I'm done.
All right. Well, it has to be understandable enough that different groups can take it and use it in different places. So, I mean, if it really was not,
right.
You couldn't understand it, it's not useful.
Right, but the critique was, as I went back and read several of these, it's you guys applied this, and I don't understand why you applied it. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
That's okay.
I'm done.
Well, I think that's probably useful to staff. They can incorporate that thought into an elaboration. So if we're truly done with the themes.
Yeah, Bruce, I just want to add one more thing, which I think emerged in our conversations, and it's implicit in theme 5, and I just want to make sure it gets support, which is since our resource-based measures consistently are based upon what's billed, or there are a great many resources that are used in care in the measures that we reviewed. And as a long-term issue, not a short-term issue, but a long-term issue, it's important that we get that people get information about the cost and value. So I know we just decided to eliminate value. The cost and impact of resources which are currently not billed and therefore not visible in the care process, the way we've done the way these measures are constructed.
Inputs are not accounted for.
Yeah, I think that those thoughts certainly were on the table many times at our meetings and ought to be reflected in the report.
So, Ashley, it looks like in the agenda the next steps are the next steps.
Actually, this is Sarah again. We did have one comment that we needed the steering committee input on, and that was comment number 14 on the spreadsheet that was submitted by Childbirth Connection.
Oh, this is the one in gray.
Yes. Yeah.
Why don't you go ahead and present that, Sarah?
Okay, I'll just go ahead and read the comment.
And explain why your staff thought that this needed some committee discussion.
Okay, so it says, we support both 1557 and 1558 and strongly urge the committee to apply them to clinician and clinical group levels as soon as testing criteria are met. It is difficult to justify excluding these levels. Is it customary for measure endorsers to specify minimum sample sizes? This should be done consistently at the appropriate step in the development, endorsement, and implementation process. We understand that NCQA has been testing some relative resource use measures at the clinical group level with the Integrated Healthcare Association in California and found that physician groups have adequate sample sizes for the diabetes relative resource use measure, along with other promising results.
And so the major question that's on the table here is, with the NCQA guideline of a minimum sample size of 400 patients per measure, the question is making sure that we have some consistency in the cycle 1 and cycle 2 of NCQA of allowing measurement at the provider, at the group practice level, in addition to health plan, which is how the measure specifications read during the vote.
So what's the question on the table for us
in
answering this? I'm a little unclear.
The question on the table is there was a lot of conversation during the committee deliberations on whether the NCQA measure could be applied to the physician group practice level, whether it could or should or should not be. And there was discussion on both sides of that. The committee, as we wrote the description of the committee discussions, there was definitely some concern about applying it at the group practice level. However, we wanted to confirm and make sure that the committee was comfortable with applying the NCQA measure at the group practice level with a minimum sample size of 400.
And what was the actual vote when we did it? And is there any confusion about what we think we voted on when we voted?
Right. Cameron, this is Ashley. I'll just hop in here. So for the first cycle of review, which was the cardiovascular and the diabetes NCQA measures, it was we went back to the transcripts and looked a little bit, and it appeared that the committee's understanding, even though on the actual submission form, NCQA had checked off both group practice and health plan level of analysis, that the committee's recommendation was based on, I think, the understanding and the discussion was about recommending it for use at the health plan level of analysis. And then when, and there was some discussion about, you know, this use of this early testing at the group practice level with IHA. And then, but again, the recommendation appeared to be with the understanding that the measure would be used at the health plan level. And then fast forward to cycle two, where you reviewed the COPD and the asthma measures from NCQA, and their, you know, their submissions were very similar. They had checked off group practice level and health plan level of analysis, but the discussion of level analysis didn't come up as specifically with those two measures. And so the measure would be moving forward with both group practice and health plan level. So we just, to Tarun's point, we just wanted to make sure that the committee was aware of how the level analysis that would be applied to the measure as it is recommended, and that you're comfortable with that given the guideline for a minimum sample size of 400.
I get it. So the discrepancy, to the extent that there is one, and I do remember the discussion in the first one, the way you described it, which was this was meant to be at the health plan level because that's who they oversee. And I thought that was pretty explicit verbally. But you're saying on the checkbox, they had also checked group practice level, and this comment is saying they think it should also be at the group practice level as long as the sample size things are consistent.
Correct.
Yeah, and that was my recollection, is that what was important was meeting the criteria for scientific acceptability, which would include sample size, but I thought we were neutral on who what entities the measures would be applied to, which would mean that provided that the other criteria were met, it could be group practice.
Is that the sense of the group on the phone? What do people want to do?
That's my recollection too, Tom.
Okay.
I would like to support the group practice level. It's essentially the same measure developer. The measure is very similar. It's just a different, you know, condition, whatever. So if we're going to, you know, be consistent, I would think we'd have to apply to both what sort of group two and group one.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree. I think
you guys.
That as well.
Yeah, I agree.
Perfect. Okay, so I think we have our answer there on that one, Steph.
Okay,
thank you.
And so just based on the input that we were given, we just want to make sure that the group as a whole is still comfortable maintaining their recommendation to move these measures forward. So it sounds like that's the case, but if any of the comments changed anyone's opinion, now would be the time to express that.
And I'd also add, this is Helen, that if there are specific comments that on the list you'd like us to also call out and have it and discuss, that's fine as well.
I presume we're going to talk about the Ingenix measure that didn't pass in a different call?
Actually, no, this is the opportunity for that as well.
Okay.
No, Sarah, so this report, this call is only for the cycle one report. So you're
okay.
Correct, Mary Kay. The next call for cycle two will include the Ingenix measures. All the Ingenix measures are in cycle two, so we're going to separate those out. The report that we had just recently sent out. So in the input you have as far as, you know, the Ingenix review process would go into the report that we're going to post next week for comments. So if you have anything to add, we can still take those for the next couple of days.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
So are there any other specific comments anyone wants to pull out for discussion?
Hearing none.
Okay. And so at this time, Carolyn, if we want to open up the lines for public comment for anyone listening in. Carolyn, are you there?
Certainly, and all lines are now open.
Okay.
Hearing none.
We're inviting public comment to anyone who is listening in on the call.
Okay. So just moving along then for next steps, the next conference call will be on December 5th, and that will be to discuss the Cycle 2 draft report comments. And other important dates coming up, as mentioned earlier, October 24th to November 7th, NQF member voting for Cycle 1 measures will occur. And you're all more than welcome to dial in October 26th for the pre-member voting webinar, and November 2nd and 3rd for the CSAC discussion of the resource use project and the recommended measures. And either way, we'll be forwarding you information on both of those events. Does anyone have any questions?
Nope.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, everyone, for calling in today. We'll be sure to incorporate all of your comments into the draft report and to the responses themselves. And we look forward to speaking with you soon.
Good.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Staff, you did a good job, and because you did, you gave us back 50 minutes of our time. Thank you.
There you go.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Goodbye. Bye. Bye.